I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up in a moment, the presidential race, 9 weeks before the Iowa caucuses. But we're going to begin this hour with the rising price of oil and what effect it might have on the U.S. economy. Crude oil prices topped $92 a barrel on international markets this morning. That's a new high, and it comes after a two-month spike that's seen prices jump by nearly $20 a barrel since August. With winter just around the corner, many analysts say oil prices will continue to rise. To help explain what's going on in the world oil market and how it will affect prices here at home, we're joined by Vahan Janjigian, editor of Forbes Growth Investor. And Vahan, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, Anthony.
Why are oil prices going up right now?
Well, there's a whole bunch of reasons, and every time prices do rise, analysts, of course, try to point to something. But first of all, it all started when Turkey talked about invading Iraq in order to go after the PKK terrorist group. And as a result, oil traders became very nervous because Kirkuk, which is in the northern part of Iraq, produces quite a bit of oil that is shipped through Turkey. And then yesterday we saw that President Bush and Condoleezza Rice and Secretary Paulson started raising the rhetoric on Iran, and there is concern that that may affect oil markets. And also, we saw yesterday that inventories in the United States fell by a much bigger than expected amount, and that made oil traders extremely nervous.
And Vahan, I'm reading as well that a weak dollar is having something to do with this?
Yes, it is, because oil, like many commodities, is actually priced in dollars. And when the dollar falls in value relative to other currencies, then the price of oil will go up. And we've seen recently that the dollar has really been weakening, especially against the euro and other major currencies, and that has contributed to the increase in the price of oil.
Now, I don't know if I'm right about this, but I haven't noticed higher gas prices at my neighborhood gas station. Am I right about that, and is that about to change?
Yeah, you are right about that. Surprisingly, gasoline prices have remained relatively stable, at least in recent periods. They are well off the highs that they set last spring. And there is some concern about whether that can continue or not. The reason the price of gasoline has not gone up with the price of oil in recent periods is because earlier this year, the refineries were having a tremendous amount of trouble. There were some fires, there were some outages, they were doing maintenance, and they weren't able to produce enough gasoline. The refineries now are actually running quite well at full capacity, so they can produce a lot of gasoline to meet demand, and we are also importing more gasoline as well. So there is no shortage of gasoline, and that's why the price has not gone up with oil right now.
So why are inventories for the crude oil so low?
Well, demand is extremely strong. I mean, the world is consuming over 80 million barrels of oil per day, and much of the excess demand or the marginal demand has been coming from countries which in the past had not been big consumers of oil, in particular China and India. So as a result, inventories have fallen. Now, OPEC has also said recently that they are not inclined to increase production any more than they are currently producing. And that's also made oil traders very nervous.
Well, we've had some pretty rough news about the U.S. economy lately. Housing starts way down, the subprime mortgage industry tanking. All this is bad news. What effect do you expect this news about oil to have? I mean, how big a role does this play looking forward?
Ironically, a weak U.S. economy may actually be good news for oil prices, because if the U.S. economy slows down, then that means that the demand for oil should fall. So we could see the price of oil fall. Now, of course, I'm not recommending that we have an economic recession to bring the price of oil down, but the U.S. economy is approximately one-fourth of the entire global economy, so problems here could result in lower oil prices.
Well, Vahan, thank you so much for helping sort this out today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Anthony.
That's Vahan Janjigian, editor of Forbes Growth Investor, talking about the price of crude oil. In just 9 weeks, the long process of choosing a president will officially begin with the Iowa caucuses. That's when the presidential horse race kicks into high gear and when candidates, pundits, and strategists start focusing obsessively on a particular group of Americans, the undecided voters, Who are these people, and why do they have so much trouble deciding, and what can we do to help them make up their minds? Well, Mark Halperin has an answer to at least that last question. The veteran political analyst for Time Magazine and ABC News has just published The Undecided Voter's Guide to the Next President, who the candidates are, where they come from, and how you can choose. And Mark Halperin joins us in the studio now, and good to have you, Mark.
Great to be here.
Tell us why you wrote this book. What's the idea behind it?
Well, I think what's important for voters is to make the best choice individually and for the country to make the best choice. There are a lot of problems and challenges facing the country. I was struck by how much information that voters get is not about who the best president would be, but who the best candidate is, who's got the best attack ads, who's doing well in the polls, who's raising money. I think what people need, and I'm hoping the book provides it, is a place to go, one place to say, let me learn about these candidates, their biographies, their issue positions, the quirky things about them, what they'd be like as president, to say, who can I choose to be the best in this difficult job?
Well, your book organizes all the major candidates, provides something about their history, background, positions on major issues. So let's go through some of this by way of giving listeners sort of a snapshot of where we are now in the race and also an idea of what's in the book. First of all, the Democrats. Hillary Clinton, she turned 60 this week. She's the front runner right now by a long shot, but you call her perhaps the most polarizing figure in American political life. What do we make of her? What does she stand for these days?
Well, it's difficult to evaluate Hillary Clinton, probably the hardest chapter in the book to write because so much is known about her. People have watched her in the spotlight for so long. This is an incredibly impressive group of people who are running, who have accomplished a lot in and out of politics, but most of them are relatively unknown. She is not. What I tried to do is approach her from the point of view of saying, what would she be like as president? What would the best case be for a presidency? What would the worst case be? She has not defined herself very well. I think that's been one of the weak points of her candidacy in terms of saying what her presidency would be like, except to say it'd be more like the last Democratic president, her husband, and less like the current Republican president. She says she would end the war in Iraq. She says that she would try to provide universal health care. But I think people need to focus more on what she's done in her past as a window into what she'd be like as president, and that's what I try to do in the book.
So what jumps out from her past? I mean, we know what kind of first lady she was. She led a big effort to try to bring universal health care to America. That didn't work out. What else jumps out in her past?
Well, I think the fact that although she is painted by many of her enemies as either left-wing and almost a Marxist, or as by some people on the left as too accommodating and too centrist, I think she has in her Senate career in particular been one of the most bipartisan people in the country. She's seen as this incredibly partisan, politically calculating person. But during her time in the U.S. Senate, not very long, but long enough, I think, to make some evaluation, she has worked more with Republicans on legislation and strategizing than probably any other Democrat and more than any Republican has worked with any other Democrat. She's worked with amongst the most conservative members of the Senate. She even worked on foster care issues with Tom DeLay when he was in the House. So she has a record and a history and a desire to be bipartisan. I think as president, she would make a try at that. Of course, the question is, and what a lot of her Democratic opponents say is, she's just not suited for that because there's so much hatred towards her on the right.
Hmm. Is she the inevitable nominee, or do we need to caution ourselves and think Howard Dean?
I don't think that the Dean analogy works because this is a much more experienced, a much tougher, a much more focused warrior than Howard Dean was. On the other hand, the Democratic race really is about Iowa because of the nature of Hillary Clinton's weakness in Iowa for a variety of reasons, because of the sort of silent agreement amongst the campaigns and the national press corps that Iowa is where the showdown is going to be. I think she can be beaten in Iowa, and if she is beaten in Iowa, I think whoever beats her, it has a chance to take her on down the road in New Hampshire and elsewhere.
Well, let's talk about the other two sort of top-tier Democrats. Barack Obama, the self-styled agent of hope and change. How do you assess his campaign so far?
Well, as a person and described in The Undecided Voter's Guide, he's one of the most impressive people of his generation. He, in many ways, although his race is front and center, transcends race and has been an incredibly strong and focused and inspirational candidate to tens of millions of Americans. I think from a political point of view, in evaluating him not as a potential president but as a candidate, he has suffered from a couple things. One is the strength of Hillary Clinton. The other is he needs to prove to people that he's ready to be president from day one. He needs his experience that he's had in his life to convince people that is the right experience for the time. He looks young. He's taken on Hillary Clinton pretty directly on foreign policy. And unfortunately for him, a campaign is probably the worst venue possible to convince someone you're ready to be commander-in-chief. A campaign is about hurtling around the country, going on Tyra Banks show, speaking at outdoor, big outdoor rallies. These are not venues that I think are playing to the challenge that he has, which is to convince people he's ready to be president.
Mm. And if we're going to talk about front runners, we have to include John Edwards, who's polling well, at least in the important state of Iowa. He's been running a campaign focusing on the divide between rich and poor. Is this something that's going to resonate with enough Americans who care about that issue?
Well, again, I think for his point of view, it only has to resonate with enough people in Iowa. He ran well in Iowa 4 years ago. He spent a lot of time there. He's not put on television ads there yet, which his supporters say when he does will help him. He has the misfortune, though, of going up against not one Goliath, but two. Mm. Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama lead him in polling in national polls, have raised substantially more money than he has, get a lot more media attention. I think Senator Edwards is counting on winning those Iowa caucuses. And again, if he does, if he or Obama is able to beat Clinton in Iowa, they get a chance to go at her one-on-one down the road.
Mm. Now, there are a few what we've been calling, for lack of a better term, sort of second-tier candidates. Among the Democrats, there's Christopher Dodd, Bill Richardson, Joe Biden. Am I leaving anyone out?
Dennis Kucinich.
Who stands out in this group, and could anyone emerge as a factor in your view?
Well, they all stand out. The chapters on them in the Undecided Voters Guide, I think, will give people a sense not just of their issue positions, but also the lives they've had. As a group, this is a fascinating group of people. Dennis Kucinich grew up incredibly poor. His family moved all the time. He lived in a car for a while. He's got ideas that appeal to tens of millions of Americans, and they're being heard. Joe Biden, probably a lot of listeners know, had suffered a personal tragedy, the death of his wife and daughter in an accident. Chris Dodd's father was a senator, and he was censured by the Senate, and there's a lot of bathos and drama in that tale. Bill Richardson, of course, potentially the first Hispanic American president. So they have compelling personal stories. They've got lots of experience, more than the people ahead of them. Their problem is those three candidates, Clinton, Obama, and Edwards, take up so much political space, fundraising, polling, press attention. It's been difficult for them to break through, much to their frustration, but they all have things to offer, and they have all been very much part of the debate.
And what's the big issue that, I mean, I guess, let me ask it this way. The war in Iraq, obviously, is the big issue that all these candidates are going to be focusing on, are focusing on. It's of overwhelming importance. How do you think the Democrats are distinguishing themselves on this issue?
It's been difficult because they largely agree in their posture towards President Bush and their posture about what they would like to do now. Now, Bill Richardson has a specific plan for a more immediate troop withdrawal. Joe Biden has a very specific plan about dividing the country into three sectarian divisions with a central capital. Those are pretty distinctive. Amongst the front runners, though, Clinton, Obama, and Edwards, their plans are pretty similar. Senator Obama makes a big point of pointing out that he voted or would have voted and opposed the Iraq war before it began. Senator Edwards makes a big deal about the fact that he repudiated his vote, but it's been difficult for them to differentiate themselves because in the future, for what they want to do, it's pretty similar.
Mark Halpern is author of The Undecided Voter's Guide to the Next President. He's editor-at-large and senior political analyst at Time Magazine and political analyst at ABC News. He'll be back with us in a moment to talk more about his book and about the Republican candidates. And later in the show, Clearing the Air, the controversy over whether toxins from Ground Zero resulted in the death of a first responder. We'll be back in a moment. It's Here and Now. We're back with Mark Halpern, author of the new book, The Undecided Voter's Guide to the Next President, who the candidates are, where they come from, and how you can choose. Mark Halpern is editor-at-large and senior political analyst at Time Magazine and a political analyst at ABC News. And Mark, let's move on and talk about some of the Republicans, starting with the front runners, Mitt Romney of Massachusetts, Rudolph Giuliani of New York. I guess it's Giuliani who seems to be ahead in the polls, and just this past week, he said he was going to root for the Red Sox in the World Series, which, of course, I'm sure had nothing to do with the fact that there are more Red Sox fans in New Hampshire than maple trees. But let's start with Giuliani. How's he doing so far? What's sort of the kernel in your book about Giuliani?
Well, Mayor Giuliani is doing surprisingly well, much better than I thought he would do. He has a real chance to win the Republican nomination, and it's the big surprise so far. You know, a lot of Americans know him and feel favorably towards him, mostly because of two things: 9/11, his record immediately after the terrorist attacks, and also his record in New York City. For a lot of people who visited New York or live in the area, they appreciate the fact that he turned around a city that had big problems and made it much more livable. The book, though, talks about biographical aspects of him that I think most people don't know, from smaller things like the fact that he started an opera club when he was in high school to larger things biographical that I think people should know and should think about. His father was arrested and served time in prison after he was involved in some illegal activity and it's been reported, and Giuliani has not denied that he served as kind of an enforcer for his own brother in a protection racket. So this is a guy who made his career early on, not as a mayor but as a prosecutor, and again, people I think don't really know what he did as a prosecutor. A lot of pros and cons described in the book to give people a fuller picture beyond that portrait, somewhat of a caricature based on 9/11 and his years as mayor.
Mitt Romney, the former Massachusetts governor, I guess people in Massachusetts at least, and even nationally, had a reputation as sort of a moderate Republican. He signed a universal health care law. He was once perceived as moderate on gay rights, now running as pretty much a hardline conservative. Is that a problem for him?
Well, I think Mitt Romney has basically three big problems in this race. And, you know, there are no perfect candidates. I think that's one point the book makes is if, as Bill Clinton liked to say when he was running for president, anybody who's looking for a perfect candidate should vote for someone else. Romney's big problems, and I talk about them all in the book. One is his Mormonism. Much to my surprise, there are a lot of people in this country who seem very adverse to voting for a Mormon, so adverse they'll tell a pollster that they either wouldn't vote for a Mormon or they'd see it as a drawback. Second is this record of flip-flopping that you alluded to, his history of taking more moderate positions to run as a candidate in Massachusetts than he's taking now. Finally, I think the third that's been least commented on, which I also talk about in the book, is people find him a little bit robotic. Mm. They find him hard to connect to, and I think he's going to have to connect more if he's going to do well in this process.
Mm. John McCain, of course, the maverick back in 2000 who nearly toppled the GOP's anointed candidate, George W. Bush, now running a hardline pro-war candidacy, going after core conservative voters instead of those moderate independents that he did so well with back in 2000. Is he all done? I mean, is he still a factor in a big way?
I very much think he's a factor, and I thought so even before the recent resurgence where he's done well in the debates and kind of gotten a little bit of, as the political analyst Austin Powers would say, his mojo back. He's can't be written off, one, because this is a relatively weak field for a variety of reasons, and two, he is a tough, experienced, patriotic guy, and the issue that I think killed him initially, that really hurt him more than the war, was his support for comprehensive immigration reform, what his opponents like to call the Ted Kennedy, John McCain bill. I think that as immigration has receded a little bit, he's been able to come back. It still, though, haunts him in Iowa and New Hampshire. It'll be difficult for him to be the nominee, but I don't write him off by any means.
In a piece in the current issue of Time magazine, your colleague Joe Klein makes an interesting case that McCain might be the Republicans' best bet in the sense that, given the problems that you talked about that Mitt Romney has, sort of the flip-flopping issue, Rudy Giuliani supports abortion rights. He has supported gun control, might not be happy with conservatives. This might make a case for McCain as being the best candidate. What do you think of that?
I think he's a strong candidate, both to win the nomination, an even stronger candidate for the general election. But again, to go back to the central point of my book, I think he can convince voters, he's got a chance to convince voters, that he would be the best president. Mm. He has the most national security experience. He's got the most experience dealing with federal issues of the candidates who are running. He's been in office the longest. And he also is someone who has run before. And in the Republican Party, they tend to have rewarded people who've run in the past, whose turn it is. But I think his strength and his calling card will be, elect me and I can get in there and I can do the job. There are going to be doubts raised about his other principal opponents for a variety of reasons.
Mm. Fred Thompson, the former senator from Tennessee, was heralded. He got in late, but heralded as the real conservative who was going to sort of swoop in and excite the conservative base. I haven't seen that happening. What do you make of what's going on?
I think that people had high expectations that he would fill a void, not just for a conservative, because his voting record is more consistently conservative than some of the others, but also for a Southerner. Republicans have gravitated towards Southern candidates for president for the most part. He has had a reputation coming to this race as being a lazy guy. I think he's done his best to live up to that reputation. He's not campaigned very vigorously. And I think also it's not easy to just walk into a race when the other guys have been preparing for a long time and put an operation together. I think he's had some logistical problems. One of the things that I think people will find from the book, though, is that Senator Thompson has had success for most of his life. He started out, got his girlfriend pregnant in high school, married her, worked his way through law school. And although he's been at times a kind of a lazy guy, he has always succeeded when he's tried. And he claims he's trying now. We'll see if he's willing to put forth more effort. I think there's no doubt that although he says he can run at his own pace, he's going to have to pick up the pace a bit if he's going to take this away from the others.
We have about 10 seconds left. Mike Huckabee and Ron Paul are sort of the two second or third tier candidates. Are they going to emerge in any way and have a factor on this race?
Difficult to do. Ron Paul has interesting ideas, but he's a little bit out of the mainstream of the party in a lot of ways. And Mike Huckabee is going to have to both raise money, but also show people he's got original ideas. So far, he seems people as likable, but not someone who can be seen as being president and with a governing agenda. That's what people are looking for, the best president.
He had a pretty good debate last Sunday, didn't he?
He had a good debate, but he's not running to be debater-in-chief. He's running to be commander-in-chief.
All right. Well, Mark Halperin, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That's Mark Halperin. His new book is called The Undecided Voter's Guide to the Next President, Who the Candidates Are, Where They Come From, and How You Can Choose. Mark Halperin is editor-at-large and senior political analyst at Time Magazine and political analyst at ABC News. It's Here and Now. To many, the name James Zadroga evokes the tragedy and the heroism of 9/11. Zadroga was a 34-year-old decorated New York police detective who died in January 2006 after he was forced to retire because of debilitating health problems following the terrorist attack. Zadroga's death was initially linked to the toxic dust and debris that he inhaled at Ground Zero. But now New York's chief medical examiner says he died from injecting crushed-up painkillers. Zadroga's father denies that claim. And 9/11 victim advocacy groups fear the new report will undermine efforts to win compensations for others sickened at Ground Zero. New York Times reporter Anthony DePalma has been following the story, and welcome, Anthony.
Thank you for having me.
Remind us what happened to James Zadroga. Give us the timeline.
Detective Zadroga spent approximately 400 hours down at the site, some of it right on the pile, some of it on the exterior, hardly ever used the mask. He started developing a cough almost immediately. By August of 2002, he was unable to work and began a battle with the New York City Police Department Pension Board for disability. They initially rejected the claims, but then came around and, based on evidence provided by his doctors, agreed that his illness had been caused by the dust. At the same time, he applied for compensation from the September 11 Victim Compensation Fund.
So then he died, and my understanding is a first medical examiner concludes that Zadroga was sickened by the dust that he inhaled from Ground Zero, essentially confirming that what was suspected earlier. Who performed that initial autopsy?
Detective Zadroga has his condition weakened, moved in with his father, Joseph Zadroga, a retired New Jersey police chief, down in Ocean County, New Jersey. And that's where he died. So the original death certificate and the autopsy, because he died at home, was conducted by the Ocean County, New Jersey Medical Examiner's Office. He did, in the autopsy, conclude that there was material there that he found to be consistent with dust. And then, based on Detective Zadroga's history, he concluded with a reasonable degree of medical certainty, which is kind of the gold standard for pathologists, that's as far as they'll go, that the death was caused by his inhalation of dust at the World Trade Center site.
Okay. And now New York City's chief medical examiner says Zadroga died from crushed-up prescription painkillers that he likely injected. Did he say that with a reasonable degree of medical certainty as well?
No. Actually, Dr. Hirsch, the medical examiner, in a letter to the Zadroga family, said unequivocally and with certainty beyond doubt the foreign material in Detective Zadroga's lungs did not get there by being inhaled at the World Trade Center.
Hmm. So is this an honest disagreement between medical experts?
Well, you might ask first how the chief medical examiner in New York City got involved in this case, because Detective Zadroga died in New Jersey. Back in September, the chief medical examiner in New York actually reversed his position on a death certificate for someone else who had died, whose family claimed was linked to Ground Zero dust. And that was a lawyer who worked nearby. She, as she tried to flee, was engulfed in the plume of dust, and within 5 months died of this fairly rare condition called sarcoidosis. Her family considered her a victim and wanted her name added to the victims list. They used as an argument that the Victim Compensation Fund had actually determined that she was a victim and awarded her family quite a substantial compensation award. So they said, well, one government agency agreed that she's a victim. The medical examiner should do the same and put her name on the list. In September, he agreed, which meant that she was a victim and her name was read along with the other victims in September. After that happened, Detective Zadroga's family went back to the medical examiner and said, well, here's our information. We'd like you to do the same because we consider Jimmy to be a victim.
Now, this is significant for a couple of reasons. I mean, beyond the tragic case of Detective Zadroga, I mean, chief among them, there's a pending class action suit to help 9/11 survivors. There's a pending federal compensation bill for injured Ground Zero workers that is actually named for Zadroga. There's real significance to this finding, at least.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Anthony. Detective Zadroga's death in January of 2006 and the medical examiner's initial finding that linked his death to the dust was a real turning point in this whole issue, because that was the first time that there was scientific and official proof linking the dust with illnesses. I think this has pushed it back.
And how's Zadroga's family reacting to this?
Detective Zadroga lived with his father during the last years of his life because he was too weak to maintain his own home. The father, Joseph Zadroga, administered all of the prescription drugs. He says there's no way that his son could have been doing that without him knowing. I think it would be helpful to understand what it is that Dr. Hirsch found.
Sure.
He sent the material to Washington, D.C., to something called the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. They found in that sample unusual materials, including talc and cellulose, and made the conclusion that they could have only gotten there inside the capillaries through the bloodstream.
I see. Now, has there been any word from the victims' advocacy groups that represent people like Detective Zadroga?
They began to criticize the medical examiner last week. There were objections to Dr. Hirsch's involvement in the first place because of this. It's actually a joint action lawsuit of some 8,000 workers against New York City, claiming that the city was negligent during the cleanup and recovery operations at Ground Zero and did not adequately protect them. So clearly a finding like this in such a sentinel case could be seen as bolstering the city's position that, well, the 8,000 people who claim to be ill are not all ill.
Even if he did die from injecting painkillers, as the chief New York medical examiner suggests that he did, he was sick well before that. So does the New York medical examiner's conclusion challenge the fact that he was in fact sick in the wake of 9/11 because of 9/11?
What the medical examiner says specifically is that the material that was found in the lungs did not get there as a result of breathing in 9/11 dust. He's looking at those slides that showed talc and cellulose. That's the difference between him and Dr. Bodden. So Dr. Bodden is saying that there is other material that was found there, including fiberglass, crushed glass, and dust, that could only have gotten there from 9/11. The things that we know are that he did spend 400 hours down there, he was well before, and that he got sick after. I don't think that this closes the case at all. And whatever little bit of certainty that we had before is now uncertain, both in both directions.
Well, Anthony DePalma, thanks for bringing us up to date on this story.
Anthony, thank you.
That's Anthony DePalma, who's covering the James Zadroga story for the New York Times. We take some heat here on Here and Now, probably well-deserved, because when it comes to sports, we tend to be a little Boston-centric. So apologies to my friends in Ann Arbor, Philadelphia, Phoenix, Portland, Oregon, Bozeman, Montana, and all of the other thousands of places that are listening to this show. But really, how can you blame us these days? The Red Sox have a 2-0 lead over the Colorado Rockies in the World Series after they won last night 2-1 in Boston. The New England Patriots are undefeated, and they look unbeatable. Sorry, Indianapolis. And in soccer, the New England Revolution are in the playoffs again, and Boston College undefeated and ranked number 2 in the nation in college football after a last-second win over Virginia Tech last night. Here to talk about this local good fortune and other news from the world of sports is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how you doing?
So you've been around here for a while. Bill, have you ever seen anything like this? It's sort of a perfect storm for New England sports fans.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything like it, and I haven't seen anything like the comfort that people are feeling as their teams are winning. There's no sense of surprise. The surprise will come if the Patriots don't run the table and win the Super Bowl. The surprise will come if the Rockies manage to beat the Red Sox in one of these games. It's a totally strange attitude for somebody who moved to Boston 35 years or so ago.
It's true. Even speaking of the World Series, the Red Sox won a close game last night, 2-1. But, you know, when they opened up that bullpen, it didn't feel like, oh, my God,
that's
they're going to blow it.
That's precisely it. In the old days, even being up 2-0 in the World Series, people would be going around asking each other what was sure to go wrong in the next game. And that's just not here anymore.
Interesting. Well, the World Series moves to Denver, Colorado for Game 3 tomorrow night. We hear a lot of talk about the thin air a mile above sea level. Is that going to help the Rockies rebound in any way?
Well, thin air doesn't help you throw strikes. You know, it's not going to help them in that respect. Their pitchers have got to stop walking guys. I like the idea that the thin air might help because I like the idea that this will turn into a legitimate series with some tension rather than a fait accompli. So I'm actually rooting for things to be a little different in Colorado than they were in Boston.
All right, well, let's move on. This is the National League Park, so the Red Sox will not have a designated hitter. That makes a difficult decision. Do they bench Big Poppy, David Ortiz, Kevin Youkilis, or the third baseman, Mike Lowell, all who have been hot?
I don't think it's a difficult decision at all. I think you put David Ortiz on the bench because, as you point out, Lowell has been very solid and Youkilis has been completely off the map in terms of how effective
he's
batting
something like 600.
Unbelievable in the postseason. So I don't see how you can possibly sit him down. And you got Ortiz to pinch hit in a spot where you think you need him anyway. And he's such a clutch hitter that he would be as good as anybody coming off the bench for one at bat.
Right,
of course, this is why I'm not the general manager or manager of a baseball team. I just have to talk about these things and no one has to pay any attention to me.
Oh, you're a young man. There's still time, Bill. Okay, you're a soccer expert. You may not be the general manager of the Red Sox. The Major League Soccer playoffs have kicked off. The Chicago Fire shut out D.C. United 1-0. The other series start tomorrow. What will you be watching for?
Well, it was a bit of a surprise that Chicago beat D.C. United. Most people are picking D.C. United to win the whole thing. But on the other hand, this is the home and away series format in the MLS playoffs. So United will have every chance to beat the Fire at home and move on in the playoffs anyway. I love to watch New York. I think they have wonderful players. They have a 17-year-old kid, Jozy Altidore, who's great fun to watch and probably can look forward sometime in the future to a career somewhere other than MLS, probably be snatched away by one of the European giant soccer power sometime soon.
And finally, quickly, pro football. The NFL is playing its first ever regular season game overseas, the New York Giants against the Miami Dolphins on Sunday in London's Wembley Stadium. Does anyone in England even know that the Dolphins are 0-7? And what's the NFL thinking of here?
I don't know if the English public knows the Dolphins are 0-7. I do know they're interested. They sold out the tickets some time back in a record short amount of time. So people care, and I guess that's very encouraging if you're trying to sell the idea of the NFL.
Okay, Bill Littlefield covers sports and more each week on NPR's Only a Game. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Anthony.
Still to come, what's for dinner when geeks rule the kitchen? Stay tuned. It's Here and Now. The science of cooking is all the rage these days. For example, Ferran Adrià, Spain's renowned chef, has a laboratory where he tests his creations. And the popular Food Network show Good Eats often features a food scientist explaining why things cook the way they do. But as Here and Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst found out, non-food scientists are often interested in the world of food as well, as in, even geeks like to cook. Kathy spoke with Susan Hassler, editor of IEEE's Spectrum magazine and host of Spectrum's internet radio show. A recurring feature of the show is geek cooking, where scientists and engineers talk about why they love to make food.
We first started this by interviewing a man named Michael Chu, who has a website called Cooking for Engineers. He has this website because he loves to cook. And so we contacted him. We did a great interview with him. And then I posted a notice on his website just asking if there were engineers who'd like to talk to us about their cooking experiences. And within about 10 days, we had about 140 responses.
Amazing.
From people all over the world who cook. And we talked to nuclear engineers and chemists and electrical engineers and software engineers. And I think what they're bringing to it is some amazing fascination with, you know, how you actually put all of these things together.
Let's start with an interview you did with a man named Kevin Weeks. He's a former software engineer. He's now a full-time personal chef. Let's listen to Kevin.
I'm a geek. I'm a techie, and I would approach recipes and that sort of thing with the attitude of an engineer, with the attitude of a programmer, with an analytical bent. I define craft as half art and half science. I was always interested in the science side of the craft of cooking. I think software also is a craft in that sense, in that it's there's a lot of art involved in writing a computer program, as well as a lot of science.
This is really interesting to me because it brings up that age-old question of, is cooking a science or is it an art or both?
I think he's got it right on the head there because it seems to be, certainly at the best level, a combination of both. I mean, the most amazing five-star chefs have an enormous and deep knowledge of food science, food chemistry, and food processes in addition to knowing about ingredients and having the artistic ability to understand how to combine things to make something really delicious.
Kitchen science is a really hot topic in the food world right now. Writers like Harold McGee, who wrote On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen, he's highly regarded among cooks, and he's kind of bridged that connection between cooks and chemists and science. And I wanted to hear another cut from Kevin Weeks, because he talks about Harold McGee, and he talks about a specific experiment, a scientific culinary experiment.
It's long been held that searing meat sealed the outside. So you sear a steak to seal the outside and hold in the juices. Harold sat down and he weighed a steak and then seared it and cooked it through. And he took another steak and he cooked it without searing it. And he found they weighed the same thing to begin with and they weighed the same thing at the end. They both lost an equal amount of juice. So clearly searing a steak doesn't do anything to retain juice. It was that sort of, wow, what's the answer to this thing that excited me about McGee's work.
You know, this whole idea of chemistry in the kitchen, I'm a food writer and a cookbook author, and when I get together with fellow food writers, we talk about how delicious things are. You know, was it yummy? Did it look gorgeous? These guys talk about why does the salt come first. They want to know about the chemical reactions when you bake a cake. This is really an interesting dichotomy of people who are so fascinated with food, but they come at it from such a different point of view.
Right. This is a set of people who, you know, recalibrate their digital scales before they start cooking. Or they know that most food contaminants are killed at 130 degrees Fahrenheit, so you don't really need to overcook your pork after all. They know why it is that you actually need to use a copper pot to make a good souffle, because there's a reaction with the copper in the pot that actually makes the souffle stand up. I know when I was talking to Kevin, he told me this story about when he was really deep in programming and hadn't transitioned over to being a personal chef yet, he would be debugging something and get so engrossed in his work that the things that he was cooking would be destroyed on the stove.
You don't have to be a chemist to ruin things on the stove, that's for sure. I have boiled pots of water for way too long.
Right. He boiled one pot down so that the aluminum, I think, melted into the top of his stove.
Been there, done that.
Here's the solution, though. His solution, he made a program for his computer that he ran on his computer so that when he was cooking things, it was a timer. He built it into the thing and he put on it, you know, what he was cooking and how long it was cooking, so that alarms would go off in intervals so that he would be reminded to get up from his machine and go and look at what was going on in his kitchen.
I think I need to give Kevin a call. I could use
one of
those.
He might be able to loan you this.
Yes. You also talked with a man named Mark Schimpf. He was a plastic chemist, and he talked about how his background really informs his cooking.
Chemistry and chemical processes in cooking are certainly very much related to each other. Chemical processes are generally a little bit more precise than cooking. What tends to happen over time as you get better and better at cooking is you begin to play around with proportions, play around with ingredients. You can't find a particular ingredient that you want, so you substitute something else. Not really something you can do when you're creating an industrial product.
Now, he's actually cooking there. That's the background noise we're hearing.
Right. We went off to a kitchen to try cooking with him, and he made us some fantastic breaded chicken cutlets. And when he was doing this, he was also explaining to us in great detail, you know, why exactly, from a chemical point of view, you need to make the cutlets very uniform so that they're cooking through at a certain heated temperature, that the heat is proceeding through the cutlet at a uniform speed. He talked about why you have to wipe off the excess egg, and why industrial breadcrumbs are, in fact, sometimes better in this situation than ones that you've made on your own.
Susan, the obvious question at this point is, are these guys good cooks? How did the food taste?
This was terrific.
Was it delicious?
Yes, it was. This was delicious. We weren't sure either whether when you reduce it, you know, if you make it analytic, does it take away all the pleasure? And I know that I talked to another man about this, Michael Tombaro, who's from New York. He's an electrical engineer who is an internet consultant and does a lot of work for Disney right now. But he told us a lot about going to visit his grandmother, his nonna, in a small town south of Rome, where she doesn't measure anything to make anything. He ended up actually taking pictures of her cooking because she was unable to tell him how much. It was just this much, how much, this much. How do you know when the oil is done? You smell it. It's done. But he also then made some food for us too, and it was fantastic. I mean, we were actually very unhappy when we had finished all of it. So it doesn't have to be the case that if you are interested in the analytical element, that all the art goes away.
Just to wind up, I wondered, in doing this project, what most surprised you talking to these engineers/chefs? You know, what unexpected things came up?
Well, I think we started this project because there's probably an idea about engineers and technology geeky persons that, you know, all they do is work and eat ramen noodles. And so we were interested to know if that was really true. And so what I think was really surprising and delightful about all of this was how varied people's culinary interests and how much people love making food and cooking for other people, so that it's not outside the domain of somebody who's working in all these areas.
Science!
That's Susan Hassler, host of Spectrum's internet radio show feature Geek Cooking. She spoke to Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst. For more information about cooking for engineers or Spectrum Radio, go to our website, here-now.org.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.